my work is interpreting the Bible, not teaching doctrine. And I, when I say this, my wife, who's a theologian, I'm envisioning saying, no, that's not the way it is. So I'm trying to be careful, but the way doctrine functions most effectively and helpfully in the Church of England is when it's shaping, again, the way we live. It's a reflection and expression of the kind of people we are and the kinds of things that we do in fact believe.
Achma Adam is a priest in the Church of England, tutoring undergraduates at Oxford University in Greek and the New Testament. He joins John and Scoop this time on the Plutopia podcast. We explore his path to the priesthood, faith and believing, doctrine, rock and roll, and postmodern thought.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Plutopia podcast. Our guest today is Achma Adam, also known as Andrew Adam. He's an ordained priest. Yeah, I know. He's an ordained priest. He's currently a tutor in New Testament at the University of Oxford. He's also a blogger, a technology observer, and author, especially about hermeneutics and the theory of interpretation. Welcome. We're so happy to have you here.
Well, it's great to be with you.
I read with interest sort of the preliminary stuff that you sent, and the first thing that I was wondering is what led you to the priesthood?
This is going to sound hokey, especially for people who are familiar with inside church baseball, because a lot of the times the people who get ordained sort of are hyper volunteers, and they really want to get in on the exciting church action. I just was talking to the priest in my parish, and I said, I realized that I didn't know how people get to be priests. What happens? Do you find them under cabbage leaves or something like that? And he said, why don't you come around my study and we can have a talk about it. So he talked about when he went away to seminary and studied and so on, and gave me, to borrow one of his textbooks from when he was in seminary, one of the most dry, boring things. I realize in retrospect, it's the kind of thing that all my classmates hated reading. But because I didn't know what was going on and had never thought any of these thoughts before, I was reading it and it was like a page turner. Oh no, well, what happens next? Oh, they didn't do that. Whoa, look at that. And I brought it back and said, Father Bayes, this is amazing. This is great stuff. And he said, you know, I want to put you in touch with a commission on the diocese. Yeah, just, you know, go to off to a meeting with them. And so I went through the whole process saying, well, you know, this is a conference about people you select to be priests, and I never really thought about it before, but if you think I'd be a good candidate, well, I'm happy to help out. That would be a swell thing. And in the course of that, we broke up into small groups. And the small group supervisor for my small group elicited from us sort of capsule life stories. Mine was, of course, a lot shorter then. And I just a few years before finished my undergraduate degree in philosophy. And a pal of mine and I used to talk about the way towns should have philosophers. We lived in a small town, a medium-sized town in Maine. We thought, This would be a good place for there to be a philosopher. Go down to the gazebo on the green and read things, give people helpful advice if they wanted to to consult you and explain some of the complications of the world to each other. Had philosophers in ancient Greece, why don't they have municipal philosophers nowadays? And I described this to the small group supervisor in my small group, and she interrupted and said, "You mean kind of like being a priest?" And I had never made that connection, not in the least. I'd never thought of myself as a priest. I had, to put this delicately, an exuberant undergraduate career. So I would never have thought of myself as the priest type. But when she put it that way, I said, well, it does, you know, seem kind of to line up. And so the Diocese of Pittsburgh said, okay, fella, go away to seminary and do good work and we'll ordain you. And they did. I was expecting to go into parish ministry, but my teachers, I went to Yale Divinity School, and my teachers and my wife both thought that I would be better suited for academic priesthood. So I studied hard and got a PhD and have been teaching ever since.
So you've never had a parish?
I've never been exclusively assigned to a parish. I've worked in parishes. I've had oversight responsibility for a parish in Tampa, Florida. I was interim for a parish in Evanston, another one. I filled in for a priest who was on leave in New Jersey, in not Morristown. It's in New Jersey. It's Johnson & Johnson headquarters.
Gosh, I used to know that. I can't think where it is.
I could look it up.
It's not far from like Yonkers. I used to work at Consumer Reports, which is based in Yonkers. So was this in the Episcopal Church?
Yeah, yeah. And now I moved from the U.S. where I was in the Episcopal Church to Scotland, where I was in the Scottish Episcopal Church. There I was on the staff of the cathedral in Glasgow, St. Mary's Cathedral. I worked full-time at the University of Glasgow and then helped out at the cathedral when needed. And the University of Glasgow had some convulsions in the theology department, theology and religion. And because I was uneasy about the convulsions and the future, I put my name out for a couple of posts, and this particular college said, say, why don't you come teach for us? And I figured that theology wasn't going anywhere at Oxford. So at least until the time I retired, I would probably be in a safe place for that, and came down here 9 years ago. Next year will be 10, and that will be the longest that I've lived and the longest that I've taught in any one location over the years. So,
and you're planning to stay there, it sounds like.
No plans to change. There's still the NHS here, and as I approach a certain age, I am more and more appreciative of having, even the NHS is overworked and underfunded, but it's there. And every time I think about going back to the US, I think about yearly having to fill out those forms where your employer says, oh, we're changing providers this year. And you say, oh, no. And you have to fill everything out. And then you go in for a hangnail or something, and you have to fill out another 5 forms, and they charge you $8,000. And you fill out another 2 weeks worth of forms, and they say, oh, we'll knock it down to $250. And you still say, well, it's just a hangnail. But That's the US.
Lots of bureaucracy here for sure. Yeah. It gets better when you get Medicare, but still. So did you ever have what you would consider a religious epiphany, or has this mostly just been sort of a rational philosophical approach to religion?
I'd say none of the above, because I'm just that way. I didn't have any exciting religious experience, conversion experience. I was a high school and indeed an undergraduate. For my undergraduate degree, I wasn't involved in the church at all and was somewhat scornful of the church, with that amusing confidence that people have at that age.
Yeah.
And my last year in college, at the beginning of the year, I met a lovely woman. Oh my goodness, her eyes were, they twinkled, but they were sharp, and she had an intense wit to her. And at the same time, she'd probably shoot me when she hears that I've ended up talking about this. She was the daughter of a priest, still is, and believed all that stuff. And I was mildly incredulous, but mildly so, because it was my last year in the undergraduate program, and I'd been through a lot in the 6 months preceding. I'd been bumped around some the year preceding. So I was entering this last year of my studies thinking, you know, there's more going on in the world than I had assumed all along. I'll just keep my ears open and shut my mouth more than I'm used to and see what I learn. So I started spending pretty much all my time with Margaret. And as part of that, ended up hearing from her. And then when I visited her family, hearing from them that these were not these were not benighted people who believed any old thing that you tried to pitch to them. They were intelligent people. They were musicians and thinkers. And it was pretty clear to me that I wasn't better than them or cleverer than them. So I felt like I had to take seriously the possibility that they were onto something. And from then on, it was just a matter of noticing that I lost my lack of faith. After a while, I just said, yeah, I believe these things, and started going back to church. And that this was the church from which the priest sent me off to be ordained. So
Just speaking of belief, I know you work a lot with interpretation, hermeneutics. What does it really mean to have faith? Do you have faith in the literal truth of the New Testament, for instance? I know you work with the New Testament a lot.
John, you just lobbed a softball right down the center. And although I have been losing weight and exercising a little bit as I get into the danger years for increasingly old people like me, I can envision myself as a slow pitch softball hitter, seeing that come in and taking a big cut at it. I think there's a huge problem that people have got themselves into, Christians, and then they foisted it on the world, about what the force of affirmations about believing mean. So that one thing that I will say to people I trust, like you, John, sorry, I don't mean to leave you out, Scoop, but I just, I'm John's the central picture in my Zoom layout here. I will say things like, I don't believe much of anything. And I'm saying that not to be shocking. Ooh, what a daring, the priest who doesn't believe. That's the most boring thing possible. The person, the clergy who think, I'll show everyone how cool and hip I am by not believing what I say I believe. Ooh. But rather, I'm saying, gravity. Do I believe in it? Well, I never really think about it at all. You know, I walk from one place to another. I do not step out of windows because that's, I have a sense of how the world is and I act on the basis of that. Would you call it believing in gravity? Well, if you use words that way, I suppose you would, but that's not what we usually mean nowadays when we say believing things. And that's what I mean when I say I don't believe it, not that I disbelieve it at all. I'm tediously conventional in the Christian things I believe, but rather I just don't spend a lot of energy believing them. Rather, it's part of my life. It's who I am and how I understand the world to be. And I go forward on that basis. So the believing side is a problem, and also the literal side is a problem, because the force of the word literal in that kind of usage does peculiar work. So for instance, a lot of people will say, well, I'm not a biblical literalist. And that makes me want to say, well, so you're not motivated to work for peace, clothe the naked, feed the hungry. So, what do you mean? Of course I'm in favor of that. Well, that's literally what Jesus says to do. So there's a problem with the literal sense there. So, no. It's just, you know, people identify literal with the bad stuff they don't believe, or stuff that the Bible very distinctly says, but they don't like it. And the stuff that the Bible seems apparently to say fairly distinctly that they do like, that's not being a literalist, that's just grasping the heart of the gospel or something along those lines. So I try to avoid the language of literal also. I think that's another sort of dead end that we've driven ourselves into and now have a difficult way of getting out.
You talk about belief. The Episcopal Church has had some disputes internally over various levels and types of belief. Female priest, gay priest, can you believe things literally or not? And how do you approach those controversies in an educational setting that you're in?
That's a great question, especially now that I'm a priest of the Church of England, which as a national church has at least notionally to be to cover the breadth of theology for pretty much anyone in England. Every person you might bump into is available, as it were, to be a member of the parish church. The places are made up of geographical parishes. You have the right to be married in your parish church, to be buried from your parish church and so on. That being the case, there can't be too fierce an exclusionary principle, a test case for, well, what do you believe? Now, of course, things play out differently in different settings with different clergy and different people who come to you. But the strength of the pattern that we live out has to do more with acknowledging our accountability to more people than just our kind of people. Let me put it that way. So that on one hand, I would describe myself as a sort of Catholic Anglican, by which I mean that most of what I do or teach or whatever is close to stuff that Roman Catholics of various degrees and temperaments might say, but I'm not a Roman Catholic. I'm Church of England. I will, every now and then someone says, well, are you going to? And I have lots of friends who've become Roman Catholics and students who have. And I just think that I'm too Church of England to be anything else. I just am. Now, to get directly to your question, teaching in a Church of England setting, as I do here, I try to teach students in ways that help them to recognize the reasons people disagree with them. I don't need to teach them more right answers. They know plenty of right answers. Other people, they'll pick up books and so on and so forth. Right answers are not what most students need. But the capacity to listen to someone who disagrees and to perceive the integrity of that disagreement, not just put it down to, oh, well, they're captives to culture or they're literalists or one thing or another, but to listen and figure out what's going on there. Because most things that are worth having an argument about theologically or politically or other things are interwoven in life in such a way that you can't just sort of butt heads over them and imagine that you're going to resolve anything that way. But by observing the life someone lives, the principles they live by, the patterns of love in their lives, and the connections they make, you're in a better position to say, well, Scoop, if you are committed to this and you enjoy that and you love these people, why is it not a problem for you to vote for this other candidate or something along those lines? Rather than just saying, heretic, burn, burn, or the church has always taught this, so you better get in line or something along those lines. Does that make a degree of sense to you?
Yes, in fact, brings up another question. The Church of England historically has had some times when the power of the throne in England had way more influence on beliefs in the church. And how do you deal with that particular? Do you do a historical overview of what the church was like then compared to what it is now?
I'm actually working right now on an article for an Anglican journal, an academic journal, in which one of my main arguments is that when people think about Anglican biblical interpretation, they too quickly go to the Bible itself and to theories, principles, doctrines, rather than looking at regular people doing things and the contexts in which, well, the kinds of things I was just talking with you about. So the first point I need to make is when it comes to the Church of England and biblical interpretation, for the first 200 years, roughly speaking, that there was a Church of England, people were killing each other over issues of the right way to interpret the Bible. Now, that wasn't the only thing. Of course, it wasn't the only thing. Lots of other political issues, class structures, economic transitions, and so on and so forth. But you can't abstract from those material conflicts the commitment that people at least understood themselves to be living out relative to interpretations of doctrine, of the Bible, of worship, and so on. And when you start going on from there, other points that I try to make in the essay I'm working on are that there are patterns of education in the 16th century, 17th century in Europe in general. You learned to read, I mean, not learn to read in the Dr. Seuss hop on pop way, but learn to read in an academic way as an exercise in rhetoric. You learned from Cicero, you learned from Augustine, you learned from Quintilian, and you learned then to interpret and to express yourself in ways determined by this rhetorical understanding that you've developed through your education. That's different from a contemporary setting in which we have lots of sort of scientific facts that I don't want to get into an argument about whether this or that is a fact. They function as facts. That's good enough for me for our conversation for the time being. But if you had said to someone in the 16th century, is it a fact that Jesus walked on water? They would say, well, of course it is. What do you mean? Why would you question this? But if you tried to say, no, I mean, like, scientifically speaking, that would have been, there wouldn't have been a discourse that supported that kind of distinction. It wasn't part of the lived world, the lived environment, to make that kind of distinction. So part of the strength, and here I'm trying to get back to the question you asked, part of the strength of the Church of England's modus lies in a shared way of life, which in its bad side is a sort of parochial Englishness. And that can be pernicious, but also the positive side is that we all live in pockets and cultures and so on. If we're not living in one in a strictly geographic sense, we're living in circles of friends, cultures to which we subscribe, of which we're a part. Scoop, I'm a rock and roller. This means that in a lot of the church circles that I'm part of, I'm really marginal because when someone says, oh, well, I was listening to the Ring Cycle the other day, and I think, oh, Wagner. And even good serious music, I just don't have the patience for, the ear for. I want to listen to some rock and roll. Thank you very much. That's good enough for me.
You'd rather hear the Clash.
Oh, tell me about it. I was thinking, I've never done karaoke, right, for whatever reason. But every now and then I think, if I ever did, what kinds of things would I want to do? And I was thinking, I would really love to sing some Style Council. I love the vision that Paul Weller brings to internationalists, to Walls Come Tumbling Down. These make me weep, John. But around here, that would be a poke in the eye to some of the people that among whom I work, some of my students. And I don't want to be that person to them.
Yeah,
but
I get that.
But that's quite who I am. That's the world I inhabit. And I don't want someone to say, oh, you've got to listen to more Wagner. Oh, please. I'm old. I'm going to die in 10, 20 years. I do not want to spend my time remaining on Earth listening to Wagner. Thank you very much.
Well, it is kind of interesting to be in a context where you're sort of listening with different ears than most of the other people around. And that sort of means that your head's kind of working differently too, right?
Oh, sure. To get back to the Church of England sort of thing, attending to the worlds that people inhabit is one of the strengths of the Church of England. We don't start with a doctrinal statement. We don't start with, you have to meet these criteria. But we invite people into this world, or these worlds for parishes or collections of parishes, and say, live with us, and this is what things are like. And we do have doctrines, but they function more as I'm going to get in trouble here. My work is interpreting the Bible, not teaching doctrine. And when I say this, my wife, who's a theologian, I'm envisioning saying, no, that's not the way it is. So I'm trying to be careful. But the way doctrine functions most effectively and helpfully in the Church of England is when it's shaping, again, the way we live. It's a reflection and expression of the kind of people we are and the kinds of things that we do in fact believe. I should ask John Scoop, the sun's going down. It's getting late here. Should I turn the light on in this room? Is this a good enough picture for you?
We can see you. It's a little pixelated right now, but
yeah, well, that's
probably
so
more the connection.
That's what I'm thinking. If you don't mind, I'll just turn it on.
Yeah.
It's going to be a flash.
You're supposed to be a bringer of light after all.
There we go.
Oh, did you see the light? Hallelujah.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, so
Big light in the sky scares, I've forgotten the Fire Sign Theater line. Big light in sky scares minority groups in Sector B.
I think that's close.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was going to ask, because I know you were influenced somewhat by postmodernism, like how does that work into your thinking?
For just those kinds of reasons, just those the kinds of ways I described, rather than looking at problems of doctrine, of biblical interpretation, of ethics or worship as what's the right answer or what's the logical outcome of this? I'm inclined to ask, what would it mean to think something otherwise? Or how is it possible to envision the world differently in order for that to be true? And that kind of question. So a lot of theological discourse, a lot of academic discourse in general, tends to operate on rails that are given by sort of established discourses. And one of the benefits of postmodern thought was saying, you don't need to be on the rails. There isn't anything intrinsically wrong with the rails, but there are other ways of thinking. There are other ways of doing things. And when I was beginning my academic work, I was trying to figure out some problems about the way biblical interpretation works. And it seemed to me that all the academic theologians I was reading were saying, well, it's got to be this way because of these doctrines and because of the nature of reality and so on and so forth. But their proposals didn't seem to me to engage the problems that people expressed. And they didn't seem to reflect the circumstances and the reasons people are reading and interpreting the Bible in the first place. So under the influence of postmodern thought, but also being an oddball, so being a rock and roller in a world dominated by people who appreciate serious music, and lots of other ways in which I'm not a square fit into the worlds I inhabit. I developed the sort of theological style of not attacking problems head on, but trying to look around the edge to see why it looks like a problem and what might be, as it were, holding the problem up. See whether instead of trying to push it down or build it up or something, we can't just turn it a little or pull out the props and then find ourselves with an entirely different situation that might itself provide opportunities for greater clarity, better understanding of the situation in which we found ourselves in the first place, that kind of thing. Postmodern thought helps me disassemble problems. That I said disassemble rather than deconstruct, because you say the word deconstruct and everyone's moaning and pulling out their hair, such of it as they have left, and saying, oh, Derrida, that's no good, and people use the word lots of different ways. But a lot of what's useful about postmodern thought comes from just that willingness to see whether you can understand a problem better, not by tackling it or overcoming it, or by saying it's not a problem, that's the way things ought to be, but rather by tinkering with it, by saying, I wonder what happens if you just pull this one element of it out. Oh, now that looks, you know, very different. And that's what the theorists whom I most admire tend to do, to not take things for granted, especially not what a problem is, and to say, well, if we think about it differently, in fact, it looks like this other thing altogether, and seeing whether that isn't a more appealing way of dealing with problems, theories, things we want to learn from. Again, relative to postmodernism, it's not A, I'm not a postmodernist. Nobody believes me when I say that because I write books that have postmodern in the title. That has more to do with marketing than things I especially believe. I don't believe postmodernism in the same way that I don't believe doctrines, as I was saying earlier, right? It's,
well, isn't postmodernism about not believing, kind of?
It's about not believing. I learn from postmodern thought, but I don't have a particular investment for myself in saying this or that is right and you've got to believe it.
There's a real problem.
Either make that argument or argue against postmodernists are very uninteresting.
And there's a real problem in the U.S. of people who have this really strong conviction, you know, fundamentalist Christians who, if you don't accept Christ as your personal savior, you're not going to be saved. You know, I don't really know quite how to respond to that myself.
Well, of course, you know, if you say I'm a priest to the Church of England, frequently enough that either upsets them or upsets people or starts them off on some other line of questioning. This is an opportunity that's not available to you, at least not with a degree of honesty, although you could give it a try sometime just for amusement.
I just tell them, well, I'm a Buddhist.
Yeah. Well, of course, that elicits some other reactions, I'm sure.
Yes.
I don't live in a world where that kind of claim makes sense. The Bible itself, he says, relieved to be getting onto his home terrain, makes a big deal in many settings about people not knowing how they ended up on God's right side. I'm a specialist in Matthew's gospel. Matthew makes a big point about you're not being able to know one way or another whether you're doing things just the right way. So there are passages where people say, oh, Jesus, this is so great. I've been casting out demons and healing and doing miraculous things. Lord, we're all about you. And Jesus says, go away. I don't even know who you are. And they say, what do you mean? We're all this. And he says, you know, just the fact that you're doing this stuff or you're saying, oh, I believe that, it does not itself cut any ice. People say, in Matthew's gospel, they get sent to hell and they say, what did we do wrong? And he said, well, You didn't feed the hungry. You didn't clothe the naked. You didn't visit prisoners. Sorry. And then the people who end up on his good side say, but we don't even know who you are, this Jesus fella. And he says, when you did this for the rough sleeper in front of Sainsbury's, when you helped people out on the bus or whatever, you were doing it for me. So you don't have to be in that setting. You don't have to be a signed on believer of one way or another to turn out to have been doing what God wanted you to all along.
It sounds like it's more about selflessness.
I mean, this is just Matthew's gospel. I'm not going to give you the Matthew's gospel intro lecture that I give in my classes, because they're different. You know, Matthew's different from John's, different from things that Paul writes, and so on and so forth. But one of those voices in the New Testament says, don't assume that just because you think you're doing church stuff, that you're on Jesus' wavelength. Even if you're doing all-star church stuff, healings, miracles, big attendance, you are going to be surprised. So don't take anything for granted. And I think that tends to be my outlook on most of these kinds of theological issues. I try to work it through as best I can, but I also try not to take anything for granted. The church teaches things. As a Catholic-minded kind of person, I say the church teaches it. On the whole, that's thousands and thousands and thousands of smart theologians who've thought it over for thousands of years, probably better at it than me. But there are places where I say, I recognize that the great theologians of the church have, to a man, and I chose that deliberately, thought this, but I just think that's wrong for these reasons. But I try not to be obstreperous about it. I try to make as respectful a case for my disagreements as I can. And I also don't tell other people that mine is the right way. I don't know that. I could be one of those unfortunates in Matthew's gospel saying, Lord, Lord, I really set those people straight. The wrong kind of people, I argued against them, and the right kind of people, I led everyone to that. And Jesus says, ooh, sorry, and your name is? This is Lebkowski now. He's a good guy. This is another, along those lines, one of the other things I say is that respect for one another and solidarity with one another is vitally important, so that if I am wrong about stuff, I want to have positive relationships with other folks who, at a moment of decisive importance, whether that be being judged before the throne of God, or when someone's outworking karma or something like that, someone can say, go easy on ACMA. He was wrong, but he was trying hard. He wasn't obnoxious about it. Cut the guy some slack. I'm 100% in the we need to stick together, show respect for one another, help each other along to the greatest extent possible. And if one of us is wrong about something very, very important, to say, I'm covering John, or, you know, Scoop's covering me. We're in this together, and you're not going to break us apart over this issue, because our love for one another, our respect for one another, is in fact the truest expression of what I take to be the truth of the Catholic faith, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I've been in my pursuits for in behalf of Plutopia and the stuff that John and I do. I follow a lot of conspiracy theorists just to see what they're up to. One lately emerged that just I had not encountered before. There are some religious authorities or, you know, researchers who claim that Jesus was actually subservient to John the Baptist, that John the Baptist was actually the power and Jesus was merely an acolyte. Have you encountered this, and how do you deal with people who bring this sort of thing up? I'm sure someone must have approached you with that.
Sure. This goes back possibly as far as the time of Jesus and John. To stick with Matthew's gospel again for a moment, Matthew makes a special scene in the gospel in which Jesus and John have a convo. John says, wait a minute, you're the special guy. I can't baptize you. You should baptize me. And Jesus says, don't worry. Let it be this way for now. He says, and thus we shall fulfill all righteousness. So Matthew tells the story in such a way that he has both John and Jesus recognizing the oddity of Jesus undergoing what is, in John's terms, as John said, according to our sources, it's a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. Well, presumably Jesus didn't have any sins to be forgiven. So Matthew says, he says, we'll just go along with it. Don't raise any issues. Luke doesn't show us the scene where John baptizes Jesus at all. He takes John off stage when Jesus gets baptized. John's gospel, not John the Baptist's gospel, but the gospel of John, also doesn't have a baptism scene as such. But John the Baptist in John the Evangelist's gospel spends a lot of time saying, I'm not the Christ. He's the Christ, not me. Not me, mistaken identity. Look at him, he's the guy. So there's so much energy put into depicting John deflecting people drawing the conclusion that he must be the anointed one, the Christ, that a lot of people think, well, this reflects the fact that a lot of people in the first century did think that John was the important one. And Jesus, having been baptized in John's movement, was just a member who then went on to become better known and so on. There's a strong argument for something like that, but to blow it up into John really was the one is probably overreading the evidence that we have from the Gospels. That said, there have been sects and groups through history who've identified themselves with John the Baptist and had no particular use for Jesus. In the book of Acts, St. Paul comes to some people and says, let me tell you about Jesus. And they say, what about this Jesus? And he talks for a while, and I want to baptize you now. And they say, we've been baptized. And he says, well, what do you mean you've been baptized? You don't know anything about Jesus. And they say, yeah, we have the baptism of John the Baptist. And he says, well, that's good, but you need a little more. You need the Jesus part. But that indicates to us that when Acts was written, people were aware that you might be a partisan for John and not care one way or another about Jesus, maybe not even have heard about him. And from that, then, people like to get head up and upset the apple cart and say he really was the one. We just don't know that much about John, and we don't have specific evidence that would make him more important in any way than Jesus. So it's a theory that goes back as long as there have been John and Jesus, but it's not widely held as a scholarly thing. It goes over well with Da Vinci Code audiences and so on.
I know there's also people who see the church as more of a political entity, a framework for social control, where spiritual truth is not necessarily the real focus, but it's really more about like trying to get people to do what you think they should do or to be socialized a certain way. How do you feel about that?
Well, the church has to be political because the polis is people. And we're not indifferent to people and how they live. Saying that we should clothe the naked is a political claim. So I'm thoroughly in favor of a political church. The question of control then gets back to the kinds of questions I was addressing before, that it seems to me the church is at its wisest when it is most cautious and most humble. So when the church says, elbows people out and says, let us make these decisions for you, that's a dangerous thing and too readily lends itself to power seekers within the church using the institutional setting to advance their own agendas, whatever the agenda is. People want the world to be particular ways, and some of them want the world to be particular ways that you and I like. More rock and roll. And some people want the world to be other ways. More Wagner. And I would be really uncomfortable in a world where political power were correlated with Wagner advocacy. Of course, being a scruffy kind of punk aficionado, that's probably where I belong anyways. Being on the outside, wearing grubby clothes and sneering at the people who go back and forth in top hats. But when the church tries to use power, that's risky business. Now, we've got a big kerfuffle going on over here right now because the Archbishop of Canterbury just addressed the government saying that their policy of wanting to relocate refugees to Rwanda for processing was an ungodly response. And people say, oh, get the church out of politics. Well, the Queen of England is the supreme governor of the Church of England. So getting the church out of politics is sort of like saying getting the get the oxygen out of the air or something like that. It's a non-starter. The problem is that they don't like the politics that the Archbishop of Canterbury was advocating there. I like that. I'm not the Archbishop of Canterbury and I are on inhabit different parts of the church. He's up there and over there, and I'm down here and over there. I think that it's shameful that a nation that does have, whether people like it or not, a state church, should think that the way to exercise our responsibility to neighbors who are fleeing war, devastation, deprivation is not to say, oh, come on, we've got plenty here, have some of ours, but rather to say, go to Rwanda, and then we'll decide whether to let you in. And the people who are upset at the Archbishop of Canterbury seem more upset at the policy he's representing than at the theology for which he represents it. So if they want to make a theological argument that he's wrong to defend refugees, I'd be interested to hear it. But there isn't much Christian theology that says every man for himself and devil take the hindmost.
Well, I think that, I mean, we have separation of church and state in the U.S., but that doesn't mean that the church can't have input or say in politics or in governance.
No. And all the more so, I mean, one of the funny things was that someone over here in the UK said, doesn't the Archbishop of Canterbury understand that we've separated the church and the state? Well, no, we haven't. So,
if you want politics out, you'd have to fire the Queen, I guess, and that wouldn't go over too well.
Just cut her off from the church and cut the... There are bishops who sit in the House of Lords. I mean, it's... you'd have to do a root and branch renovation of government, which, to be fair, you know, may be on the horizon, and not in a way that is going to be great for people, I predict.
But, yeah, it's hard to see what's coming. Yeah. We have reached the end of the hour.
Oh, goodness. And I probably haven't said a single interesting thing all hour.
Oh, you definitely have.
You kept us quite
interested. You can come back and say more sometime.
Anytime. You know where to find me.
Right on. We'd love to have you back. Well, this has been great. Thanks so much.
Rock and roll more. Pardon?
Right on. Right on. We'll do a whole show on rock and roll.
Brilliant.
Okay. Thanks so much, ACMA.
Thank you.
Thank you for your patience, for putting up with a somewhat eccentric theologian. It's good to be in touch with you. And as I said before, we're in this together in a very, very long run. And the things that hold us together, we've got to hang on to tight. And the things that would separate us, we've got to be gentle with and respectful for. But I want to make sure that we don't lose touch.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.